Hello and welcome to our KrausCast webinar series. My name is Amy Beecham and I'm the Marketing Director here at Kraus Financial. Today's topic is how to leverage the double gifting plan when two spouses are in the nursing home, hosted by our Senior Relationship Manager, Erin Kempen. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, you can go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar and we will answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint and a case study can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now we will get to today's presentation. Erin, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, everyone, for joining today as we'll be talking about Medicaid planning when we have two spouses in the nursing home. How to leverage what we refer to as the double gifting plan. A little bit about myself. As Amy mentioned, my name is Erin Kempen, and I have been specializing in Medicaid crisis planning at Kraus Financial for almost 15 years now. So I'm not sure where all the time goes, but it's been a while. So a little bit about Kraus Financial before we get in to the presentation. We've been in the Medicaid planning space for over 30 years, founded by an estate planning and elder law attorney by the name of Dale Kraus. We now have over 40 professionals on staff with one sole goal, and that's to make long-term care planning easier for you and your clients. Our primary product that we're most commonly known for is the Medicaid compliant annuity. We do over 400 Medicaid annuity cases per month. In addition to that, we also offer irrevocable funeral expense trusts, so prepaying those funeral expenses. And also for your pre-planning clients, we also offer long-term care insurance. So when it comes to Kraus Financial, we really want to be your one-stop shop for all long-term care planning needs for you and your clients. So we certainly appreciate all the business and stuff you sent us over the years. We wouldn't be here without you. And again, our goal is to make your life easier when it comes to long-term care planning for your clients. So the goal of today's presentation, first, we'll briefly define what the Medicaid compliant annuity is and its requirements. Then we'll discuss how that Medicaid compliant annuity can be used to protect assets in the various situations, and again, to accelerate your client's Medicaid eligibility. And then finally, we'll explore an in-depth case study. Again, we're going to be focusing on what happens when you have two spouses that are in the nursing home at the same time. So it's not a situation that comes up all that often, but when it does, it's good to know what options are out there when it arises. So now we'll first just do a brief overview of about the Medicaid program and what a Medicaid compliant annuity is. We're just going to briefly touch on this stuff. So if you do have further questions about the Medicaid qualification criteria and things like that, know that we do have a lot of other educational materials on our website, krausfinancial.com. So visit that video library, look at some other case studies if you do have more questions and want a more in-depth knowledge on the Medicaid program. But just to give you a brief overview, what is the Medicaid program? Well, the Medicaid program is a joint federal and state program. And when we're talking about Medicaid, we are referring to Medicaid within a nursing home setting. So there are a bunch of various different Medicaid programs. However, the one we're going to be discussing today is within a nursing home setting. So applicants, in order to qualify for Medicaid, must meet specific financial and non-financial criteria to qualify. And since it is a joint federal and state program, the federal sets the guidelines to the Medicaid program, and then each state interprets those rules slightly differently. So the Medicaid rules for the state of Wisconsin will be different than the state of Pennsylvania, which would be different than the state of Florida, which would be different than the state of Texas. So the framework is going to all be the same. However, different states will have different nuances. And again, each individual must meet specific financial and non-financial criteria. Since we're focusing on individuals within a nursing home setting, the non-financial criteria is pretty straightforward for these individuals. They typically need to be age 65 or older, and or disabled or blind. Again, being in the nursing home, they're typically going to meet that criteria. And they also need to be a U.S. resident or a qualified ALD. Now, when it comes to the financial criteria, this is where most people have a little bit of difficulty. And again, I'm not going to get into too many details, but just know for an income standpoint, generally speaking, the individual's income needs to be less than the monthly cost of care in order to qualify. And from an asset standpoint, there are asset requirements that they have to meet, typically for a single individual. That's $2,000. If there's a healthy spouse, they're allowed a separate amount, known as a community spouse resource allowance. So just know that there are asset requirements that they have to meet as well. Again, we're not going to touch too far into that in this, and we do have some other materials, other videos that we'll touch on that in much more greater detail. So why is Medicaid important? Well, the reason is the sheer cost of it. The average monthly stay in a semi-private room in a nursing home in the United States is currently $8,669 per month. If you annualize that, that's almost $105,000 per year just to stay in a nursing home. So it comes as no shock as most families just simply cannot afford spending $105,000 per month. To kind of put that into some context, if you're looking at sending a kid to Harvard, on the Harvard website, Harvard estimates it'll cost around $80,000 per year, which includes tuition, room and board, food plans, things like that. So 1 year, stay in a nursing home costs about $25,000 more than sending someone to Harvard University. So you know, it's a huge expense. Everyone talks about saving for college, saving for their kids' college, but not many people think about the expense that they may have at their final years of their life. They have to end up in a nursing home. $105,000 is a lot of money to spend in those final years of that individual's life. So Medicaid is important because they're going to pay for that individual's custodial care. Basically, what happens is once someone qualifies for Medicaid, more or less all that individual's income will go towards their monthly share of costs, and then Medicaid will pick up the difference. So the individual is just basically paying essentially all of their monthly income for their share of costs, and then Medicaid is picking up the difference. So that's why Medicaid is so important, as it's at $104,000, people just can't afford it, so they can qualify for Medicaid, and then they just spend their monthly income, and that goes towards their share of costs, and then Medicaid picks up that difference. So what is a Medicaid-compliant annuity? So a Medicaid-compliant annuity is a powerful spend-down tool that is utilized in crisis Medicaid planning. So technically speaking, what a Medicaid-compliant annuity is a single premium immediate annuity that meets the requirements of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. So basically, it's a special type of annuity that has added restrictions that meet the Medicaid requirements. And if it does so, whatever is put into the annuity will be converted simply into a stream of income. Now, if you have a client that walks in your door and they say they have an annuity, I would be shocked if that annuity is Medicaid compliant. There's, to the best of my knowledge, about five or six carriers nationwide that offer a Medicaid-compliant annuity. It only really serves one purpose, and that is for Medicaid qualification purposes. So if someone walked in your office and they had a Medicaid-compliant annuity and didn't need it for Medicaid planning purposes, I would question why they own that product and the individual that sold it to them. As a Medicaid-compliant annuity, again, is a very specific product used for Medicaid crisis planning. So what the Medicaid-compliant annuity does is it converts what Medicaid would normally view as an asset into simply a stream of income, and it's utilized to accelerate a client's Medicaid eligibility. And depending on the case facts, depends how this Medicaid-compliant annuity works. So the planning strategies for a single person are going to be different than the planning strategies for a married couple. And even within that single person, there may be multiple planning strategies. And again, depending on your client-specific case facts will depend how that Medicaid-compliant annuity is utilized, but the end goal is all the same, and the Medicaid-compliant annuity is used with other planning strategies in order to protect your client's assets as much as possible while accelerating their Medicaid eligibility. So the goal of Medicaid crisis planning, again, is to protect as much of your client's assets as possible while accelerating their Medicaid eligibility. And the Medicaid compliant annuity is a very powerful tool that can be utilized in order to do that. Now, in order for a Medicaid compliant annuity to work, and by work, I mean be treated simply as a stream of income and not a countable resource or not a transfer for less than fair market value, the annuity needs to meet five requirements. The five requirements that the annuity must meet, and it must meet all five of these requirements. If one of these requirements is not met, then the annuity is either going to be considered a transfer for less than fair market value or a countable resource. So the annuity needs to be irrevocable, non-assignable, be actuarially sound, make equal payments, and the state has to be named as a beneficiary in the proper position. So if you're scrambling to write all that down, don't worry. We have a slide coming up to go over each one of those requirements. So the first requirement being irrevocable. So the Medicaid compliant annuity needs to be irrevocable in every sense of the term. Basically, once the annuity is purchased, it is completely set in stone. You may not make any changes to it whatsoever. So once the annuity is purchased, you may not change the owner of the annuity. You may not change the annuitant. You cannot change the payee. You may not change the term. You cannot add money to it. You cannot electively take money out of it. You cannot change any of the beneficiary requirements. So again, once the annuity is purchased, it is completely set in stone. You may not make any changes to it whatsoever. If changes can be made to it, then again, the annuity is not going to meet the requirements and be treated either as a transfer for less than fair market value or a countable asset, depending on what issues they have. So it's completely set in stone, may not make any changes to it whatsoever. The second requirement is the annuity is always referred to as non-assignable. Now, if you watched any time of daytime television in your life, I'm sure you've heard some companies, they have very catchy jingles that will purchase structured settlements, annuities, life insurance policies, lottery winnings. They'll purchase the future payments of those products. Well, a Medicaid-compliant annuity is going to have specific language in that contract that explicitly prohibits those types of transfers, and that's being referred to as non-assignable. So we cannot assign those future payments to a third party. We cannot sell the contract on the secondary market and receive cash for it. So the annuity is completely non-assignable. It will have zero value on the secondary market. So these companies will come in and they'll say, hey, we have an annuity contract. I'd like to buy those future payment streams from you. Here's a lump sum cash value to purchase those future payments from you. Well, there's language in this contract that prohibit those types of transactions, and that being it's non-assignable. If the contract was assignable, then it would be considered a countable resource to the extent that it could be sold. So again, there's explicit language within these contracts that prohibit the sale of the future payments on the secondary market. So it has zero cash value, zero value on the secondary market. It is completely non-assignable. So that's the second criteria. The third criteria is it needs to be considered actuarially sound. So what this does is it establishes the maximum term of the annuity, the maximum term the annuity may be. So in order for the contract to be actuarially sound, the term of the annuity may not exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. So depending on your state, some states will use a Medicaid life expectancy table that is published by the Social Security Administration. Other states will use a state-specific table that they publish themselves. If you're not sure, if you go to crossfinancial.com and create a free attorney access account, you can log in and see what your state's life expectancy table. But regardless of what table your state uses, the Medicaid life expectancy table will be an age and gender-based table. So you just take a look at the whoever is purchasing the annuity, you look at their age at time of purchase and their gender. So let's say we have an 85-year-old male who is purchasing this annuity, and I'll use the Social Security Administration table for an example. We'll just go to 85 years old and male, and we'll see a number. That number will be in years, and I believe every table is in years. I don't think I've ever seen a life expectancy table listed in anything but years. So it's typically listed in years. So for the Social Security Administration table, it is in years. So for an 85-year-old male, you'll see they have a life expectancy of 5.65 years. To put that on a monthly basis, because Medicaid-compliant annuities are typically purchased in a number of months, we will just simply multiply that number by 12. In this case, that'd be 67.80 months. So again, this establishes the maximum term of the annuity may be purchased. So if you have a 67.8 month life expectancy, and we know the term of the annuity must be equal to or shorter than the owner's life expectancy, this means the maximum term annuity, in this example, what we may purchase, will be 67 months. If the term of the annuity is purchased for 68 months, we would exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy, and this annuity will likely be treated as a transfer for us in fair market value. Again, this just establishes the maximum term. So for this 85-year-old male example, 67 months will be the maximum term. However, we may use a shorter term annuity. So we could use a 60-month, a 48-month, a 24-month. The shortest term Medicaid-compliant annuity available is 2 months. So we could go down that short if we wanted to, or if the case facts came out that way. So again, it establishes a maximum term, but we can use the shorter term if we wish. So the third criteria, the actuary sound test, again, is so long as the term of the annuity does not exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy, it will meet this test, and it may be shorter than, just not greater than. So the fourth requirement is the annuity needs to make equal payments. And these types of annuities are also going to make a fixed number of payments. So let's say we have a 48-month Medicaid-compliant annuity that our client purchased. The annuity is going to make 48 equal, typically monthly payments. So the first payment will be the exact same as the 48th payment. So since these payment terms need to be equal, we cannot have an inflation rider on there. We cannot have a cost of living adjustment rider on there. The first payment will be the exact same as the last payment. And we can no longer have a balloon style annuity. This is where we used to be able to use these way back in the day. We can no longer use them anymore. But this balloon style annuity would be where we make a very small monthly payments for basically every payment. Then the last payment would be a very large balloon payment. We can no longer use those anymore. As the first pay, again, we have to make equal payments. So the first payment has to be the exact same as the last payment. And then after that final payment, the annuity is going to be effectively closed out. So again, using a 48-month annuity example, after that 48th payment, the annuity will not make a 49th payment. The annuity will be closed out. There'll be nothing left in the annuity, and it'll be done. It will no longer be in existence. If the owner were to predecease the term of the annuity, so let's say they pass away after 36 months of that 48-month annuity, there's 12 payments remaining in that annuity, then any remaining payments in the annuity will get paid out to whomever the client names as death beneficiary, which brings us to the fifth and final requirement. The state does have to be named as a beneficiary in the proper position for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on behalf of the institutionalized individual. So in most circumstances, the state is going to be named as a primary death beneficiary. However, there are some exceptions that apply. So if the owner of the Medicaid annuity has a minor and or disabled child, that individual may always be named before the state. And if it's a married couple situation and that there's a healthy spouse living at home, known as a community spouse, if the institutionalized spouse is purchasing the annuity and they have a community spouse at home, we may name the community spouse before the state as well. But in most situations, when you're planning using these annuities, the state is going to be named as a primary death beneficiary. However, know that, that those exceptions do exist, and you may always name those individuals before the state. And then after the state, you may name whomever you'd like as a beneficiary. So most people will name their heirs, their loved ones' kids, as a contingent beneficiary after the state. If there's anything left over after the state's been repaid, then anything would then get paid out to whomever be named after the state. Again, typically people will name their kids or heirs after the state as a contingent death beneficiary. So now we know what a Medicaid compliant annuity is. Again, just know it needs to meet all five of those criteria: irrevocable, non-assignable, actuarially sound, make equal payments, and the state being named as a beneficiary. If you work with Kraus Financial, we will make sure that that annuity does meet all those requirements, so you don't have to worry about that. Depending on the client situation, as I mentioned earlier, depends how we utilize this Medicaid compliant annuity. So I mentioned the planning for a married couple is going to be different than the planning for a single person. So planning for a married couple in a normal situation, we see about 95% of the time is when there's one spouse that's in the nursing facility and the other spouse is healthy at home living in the community. We typically refer to this type of planning as traditional community spouse planning. And basically what we will do is we'll leave each spouse with the amount of assets they're allowed to have. So if you're an institutionalized person, in most states, they're allowed to keep $2,000 in their name. And the healthy spouse, the community spouse at home, is usually allowed to keep a separate amount known as the community spouse resource allowance. This will be dependent on what state you're in, as it's state specific, but generally speaking, the community spouse is usually allowed to keep up to about $154,000 and change as their community spouse resource allowance. Any assets in addition to that, we will typically have the community spouse purchase the Medicaid annuity. So we're leaving each spouse with the amount of assets they're allowed to have. Then we're taking the excess assets and having the community spouse, the healthy spouse at home, purchase the Medicaid annuity. By doing so, assuming the couple that did not have any previous gifts in the past 60 months, were able to immediately qualify the institutionalized spouse for Medicaid benefits, and as long as the community spouse outlives the term of the annuity, we are able to protect 100% of the assets on behalf of the community spouse. Now, most states, remember, the annuity rules actually sound criteria. We cannot exceed Medicaid life expectancy, but we can use a shorter term. So we can use a shorter term for that community spouse, so the community spouse can use those funds back relatively quickly, and also avoid the risk of having the community spouse predecease the term and having the state be named as a beneficiary for state payback. So again, general planning strategy for a married couple, and again, we're not going to get into too much detail. We have other videos and webinars on our website, crossfinancial.com, that get into these in much greater detail. But general planning strategy, leave the community spouse with the excess assets, have them buy the annuity, immediately qualify institutionalized spouse for Medicaid benefits, community spouse, 100% of the assets protected, assuming they outlive the term of the annuity. Planning for a single person, it can be much different than a married couple. For a single person, we don't have that healthy spouse at home, so we cannot leave those excess assets. And we will typically utilize what's referred to as the gift and annuity plan. This is where we are going to intentionally make a gift of approximately one half of the assets. We're going to use the approximate other half of the assets to purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity. Now, anytime you gift assets and apply for Medicaid within 60 months, there's going to be a penalty period that's associated with that, where the client will have to privately pay for a specified period of time that's determined by the amount of the gift that was gifted. So what we're going to do is use some calculations and some formulas to calculate the maximum amount that can be gifted while we put enough in the Medicaid annuity so the client can privately pay through that penalty period that was by gifting assets. So for example, we have a person, we gifted assets it works out to be there, it's going to be a 15-month penalty period. We're going to purchase a 15-month Medicaid compliant annuity. So during that penalty period, the client has their income plus the annuity income to privately pay for their care. And after the penalty period ends, the annuity stops making payments and the client starts receiving Medicaid benefits. So the advantage of this plan is they're able to protect approximately one half of their assets by means of that immediate gift. So we're making an immediate wealth transfer and then we're privately paying through the penalty period that was created by that wealth transfer. And then Medicaid starts paying after the penalty period ends. Again, we're able to protect about half of their assets by means of that immediate wealth transfer. So those are the planning strategies for the typically the married couple where one spouse is in, one spouse is at home, the single person. Well, what happens if we have both spouses institutionalized at the same time? So since we don't have that healthy spouse at home, we don't have a community spouse, so there is no community spouse resource allowance. And unfortunately, in most states, when both spouses are institutionalized, they're only allowed to keep $3,000 in their name, which is actually less than if they're two single individuals, because typically just a single individual is allowed to keep $2,000 in their name. So if a married couple is both institutionalized, unfortunately, they're only allowed to keep $3,000 between the two of them in most states. So there's definitely a very low asset threshold. So what do we do in these situations? How do we protect assets while accelerating their Medicaid eligibility? So the solution is when both spouses are in, we're going to utilize something similar to the gift and annuity strategy that we would utilize for a single person. However, since there's two people in, there's going to be two annuities. And we refer to this as the double gifting plan. So basically what's going to happen is it'll be similar to the single person where we're going to make a lump sum gift of approximately one half of the couple's total assets. And then each spouse is going to be looked at individually when it comes to their income test. So we're going to purchase two separate Medicaid annuities, one for each spouse, so they can privately pay through the penalty period that was created by gifting the assets. So we're going to gift about half their total countable assets and have each spouse purchase their own Medicaid annuity so they can privately pay for their own care through the duration of the penalty period. Then just like the single person, once that penalty period ends, the annuities will stop making payments and the clients will start receiving Medicaid benefits. So again, similar to the single person plan, we're going to divest about half their assets. The penalty period is going to be split between the two, and both of them are going to purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity. We must purchase two annuities because each spouse is going to be looked at from the income test individually. So each spouse's income, remember, needs to be less than their cost of care. So you're going to have to factor in their individual income, their individual cost of care, and make sure that when we purchase the annuity, each individual spouse's total income is going to be less than their individual cost of care. They're each going to have a penalty period. The penalty period is going to be split between the two that they're going to have to privately pay. So again, in most states, when both spouses are in the institution, any gifts made by either spouse is going to be combined when they apply, and the penalty period will be split between the two. So for example, if we're in a state that has an $8,000 divestment penalty divisor, just to back step one second, if you're unfamiliar what the divestment penalty divisor is, this is a number published by each state. Each state is going to have a different divestment penalty divisor. It is set to represent what the state feels the average monthly nursing home cost is in your particular state. And essentially what the number represents, this $8,000 divestment penalty divisor, for every $8,000 that's gifted, that will create a one-month penalty period where the client would have to privately pay. So for example, in a married couple situation, if the couple, if one spouse, another spouse, doesn't matter, we're going to combine the total gifts of the couple. and they gifted $16,000. That would equate to a two-month penalty period. Medicaid is going to split that penalty period equally between the two spouses. So in this example, each spouse would have a one-month penalty period where they'd have to privately pay. Whereas if they were single, they'd have a two-month penalty, but since they're a married couple, they split that penalty equally between the two spouses. One spouse A has a one-month penalty period. Spouse B has a one-month penalty period for that $16,000. Now, if the one spouse were to predecease the penalty period, so let's just say we have a couple, each spouse in that couple is serving a 10-month penalty period, and one of the spouses passes away after 5 months, there's 5 months remaining in that penalty period, that 5 months will then get transferred over to the surviving spouse. So that surviving spouse will then have a total penalty of 15 months in this example. So it's split. And then if one spouse predeceases the penalty period, whatever penalty is remaining for that spouse will get added to the surviving spouse's penalty. So they will have to pay for the full penalty if they were single, for example. So if they predecease, the remaining penalty is then added on to the surviving spouse's penalty period. So when do we use a double gifting plan? We are typically going to use a double gifting plan when both spouses are residing in a Medicaid-approved facility. They are expected to remain at the facility indefinitely. If they have long-term care insurance or Medicare benefits, they have exhausted their Medicare benefits and they have long-term care insurance. Either their long-term care insurance is not sufficient to meet the full private pay amount, or they have exhausted their long-term care benefits and they're ultimately paying out of pocket and they have assets in excess of the Medicaid limits. So again, the key takeaways here are you have two spouses that are in a Medicaid-approved facility, and it's very important that they're in a Medicaid-approved facility because in order to qualify for Medicaid, they would have to be in a Medicaid-approved facility. So they're in the facility, they are privately paying, and they have assets in excess of the Medicaid limits, which is not that hard to do with both spouses. And again, in most states, that's only $3,000. So most individuals that come into your office are going to have more than that. So that would be a situation where we'd want to look at the double gifting plan. So now that we know kind of what the Medicaid compliant annuity is, we did a high level overview of the Medicaid program. Let's get into the meat and bones of this and let's get into our case study. So in this example, we have George and Mary. George is an 85-year-old and he's been in the nursing home for a few months. His wife, Mary, is about to move into the facility as well. Their children were taking care of Mary, but they can no longer do so, so they're going to have to transfer her into the nursing home within the next week. And they realize that at the cost of care that they're paying, they're not going to be able to afford their care very long. They're afraid their parents are going to go bankrupt. They're going to lose everything. They're going to be kicked out and they're going to be on the street. And most importantly, they're not going to be able to get the care that they so desperately need. They saw your Facebook ad and they decided to come into your office for some help. So first thing you do after you're telling them everything is going to be okay, we'll be able to help you out. Let's look at our financial case facts. So we have George from income from Social Security and pension of $2,400. We have Mary, again, income from Social Security and pension of $2,100. They're each spending $9,000 a month for their cost of care. So the couple spending $18,000 a month for their care costs. They have total countable assets of $295,000. And in this particular state, our divestment penalty divisor is $8,000. Remember, again, that divestment penalty divisor represents what the state feels is the average cost of care, but it also represents how much they can gift that will equal a one-month penalty. So in this state, for every $8,000 that's gifted, that will equate to a one-month penalty. So if they do absolutely nothing and just continue to privately pay for their care, again, for the couple combined, that's $18,000 per month. They'll deplete that $295,000 in as little as about 16 months. Should that occur, obviously they'll have nothing to pass on to their loved ones. One thing that was always very important to George and Mary is they wanted to leave at least something over for their heirs. They wanted to pass something along to help maybe offset the cost of college or, you know, do whatever, just leave some form of legacy for their loved ones. And by privately paying $18,000 per month, the likelihood of that is not that great. So we can certainly do better. So the solution is we're going to look at the double gifting plan to accelerate this couple's Medicaid eligibility while ensuring we have a wealth transfer to their heirs. As again, that was very important to them. They wanted to make sure that they were able to pass along something, at least some form of legacy to their loved ones. So together, they're going to divest approximately one half of their assets. And then we're going to use the other approximate one half to purchase two Medicaid compliant annuities, one for George and one for Mary. So each one of them will have sufficient income to privately pay for their care through the penalty period. So the first step of this plan is to determine the spend down amount or our at-risk assets, the amount of money we have to play with. So with George and Mary both being in the nursing home, they're only allowed to keep $3,000 between the two of them. However, to avoid being right on the edge of Medicaid eligibility, if they are $1 over that, they're not going to meet the asset test. They'll be over-resourced. And they're not going to be otherwise eligible, and it's going to blow up the plan. So we want to build in a small buffer zone there. So we're going to leave this couple $2,800. So we started with $295,000. We're going to leave them with $2,800, which means our spend down amount is $292,200. That's the amount we have to play with. We're going to take that amount and split it between the gift amount and the two annuities for George and Mary. So now we're going to calculate a number that we call in-house as the burn rate. And this number really reflects during this plan how much money we're spending each month this plan is in place. So we want to take a step back and take a 1,000-foot view of what we're planning to do, what our ultimate goal is. Because if we recall, we want to gift assets while pay for 1 month's care, because during that penalty period, we're going to have to pay for care. So we want to maximize the gift amount while ensuring we have enough left over for this couple to privately pay for their care. So we're going to do that by taking their combined cost of care, so $18,000, each one had a $9,000 cost of care, and we're going to subtract their combined monthly income of $4,500 to get a monthly income shortfall of $13,500. So each month this plan is in place, we're going to have to come up with $13,500 so this couple can privately pay for their care. Now, we want to privately pay for their care and maximize our gift. So since this penalty period is going to be split between the two of them, we're going to take two times the investment penalty divisor, and we're going to add $16,000, $8,000, if you want to think of it, $8,000 for each spouse or gifting away. So we need $13,500 of additional income. We're also going to be gifting $16,000 each month this plan is in place to get a burn rate of $29,500. So we're going to take $13,500 to pay for the cost of care, and we're going to gift $16,000 to equal 1 month penalty for each spouse, because each spouse will essentially gift $8,000. So that will create a 1 month penalty for each spouse. So the combined monthly gift amount will be $16,000 for this couple. So each month this plan is in place, again, we're going to burn through $29,500. And again, remember why we're using the double figures, because there's two individuals. So any divestment, again, is going to be split between the two spouses, so we're going to double up the gift. So each spouse will receive 1 month penalty. And then each spouse, again, is going to be responsible for paying each for their individual cost of care. So we're going to have to generate additional money so they can privately pay for their each individual share of cost. So we're going to be purchasing two Medicaid annuities here. So now we know the burn rate. We're simply going to take our spend down amount, the $292,200, divide it by the burn rate, how much money we're spending each month this plan is in place, to get the length of the plan. And this ultimately tells us how long their money is going to last. So they have $292,200. We know we're going to spend $29,500 per month, which means their money is going to last them 9.9 months. However, to avoid being right on the edge of Medicaid eligibility, and just to make everyone's lives easier, we're simply going to round that figure up to 10 months, and this is going to be a 10-month plan. We're going to make 10 months worth of gifts, and you guessed that we're going to purchase a 10-month of Medicaid-compliant annuities for these couples. We also want to round up because these annuities are going to pay a small amount of interest, and again, we just want to ensure that their total income is less than their cost of care. If it's equal to or greater than, they're going to fail the income test, and they're not going to be considered otherwise eligible, and the penalty period will not start. So, again, we just want to build in a small buffer zone there, and by rounding that number up, we'll increase the gift. Thus, there'll be less money left over for the annuities. So, are you going to be a 10-month? This length of our plan is 10 months. That means we're going to make 10 months worth of gifts. So we just simply multiply 10 months by the combined investment penalty divisor of 16,000 to get a total gift amount of $160,000. So this couple is going to gift $160,000 outright. That could be to an irrevocable trust. It could be outright to loved ones. It could be to a charity. Whatever your client's wishes are, they're just going to make that immediate gift. This example, they're just going to gift it outright to their kids. So they're just simply going to cut a check payable to their kids for $160,000. They're going to cash that check. That gift is now complete. That $160,000 is now wholly owned by their kids and held in their name only. So we eliminated $160,000 by means of a gift. So now we had $292,200 to start with. We just reduced that amount by writing that check to the kids for $160,000. Now the couple has $132,200 to be split between the two to purchase the two annuities. Now, most situations, we can't just simply divide that number by two, especially with this case facts. So if you recall, they had different levels of income. And when we do this, we have to make sure that each spouse, their total income is less than their individual cost of care. So this is kind of where some guessing and checking can come into play. If you work with us, we will use a time value money calculator to determine how much should go into each Medicaid annuity. But if you're just doing it by yourself, you know, you can just simply kind of guess and check. Again, we want to make sure that each individual's total income when we're factoring in the annuity income plus their Social Security and pension income is going to be less than their private pay, going to be less than their cost of care. So again, you work with us, we can calculate all this for you. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of just a guess and check and play around the figures until it works to your liking. But again, the primary goal is we just can't have it greater than their cost, individual cost of care. So we did the math on this one, and we calculated that George's Medicaid compliant annuity is going to be purchased for $64,600. Again, since this is a 10-month plan, we're going to be using a 10-month Medicaid compliant annuity. And this annuity will pay George $6,465 per month for the next 10 months. Since George is a single individual, George is purchasing this as an institutionalized individual, he's going to be the owner annuitant and payee of this annuity. Since they do not have any minor and or disabled children, and his spouse is institutionalized, state Medicaid agency is going to be named as primary death beneficiary for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on behalf of George, and he's going to name his kids as their contingent beneficiary. So we just took $64,600 of our remaining $132,200, put it into George's annuity, which means the remaining amount, $67,600, will go into Mary's annuity. Again, it'll be a 10-month annuity. It will pay Mary $6,765 per month for the next 10 months. Again, Mary being an institutionalized individual, she's going to be the owner, annuitant, and payee. The primary death beneficiary, again, no minor or disabled children. And George is also institutionalized, so the state Medicaid agency will be named as primary death beneficiary for the amount of Medicaid provided on her behalf. And she's going to name their kids as the continued beneficiary in the event she were to predecease and there's money left over after the state's been paid back. So now we purchased the annuity, we made the gift, we purchased the annuities. Now we need to apply for Medicaid benefits. And this is a very important step because in order for that penalty period to start, Medicaid must consider them otherwise eligible. And what this means is you're going to apply for Medicaid benefits. Medicaid is going to come back and say, great, you know, George and Mary, they meet all the non-financial Medicaid criteria. They meet all the financial Medicaid criteria. However, since they gifted $160,000, there's going to be a penalty period that's associated with that. $160,000 gift would mean that's a 20-month penalty. Since it's the married couple case, that penalty period will be split equally between the two spouses. Each spouse is going to serve a 10-month penalty period. We're going to come back and say, great, Medicaid, that's exactly what we had planned. We purchased these 10-month Medicaid annuities so they can afford that 10, so they can privately pay through that 10-month penalty period. Then after that 10-month penalty period ends, the annuity is going to stop making payments, and then Medicaid will start picking up the Medicaid bill. So again, we eliminated their assets by means of a $160,000 gift, and we purchased two Medicaid-compliant annuities totaling $132,200. Left them, and then we left them with $2,800 as their resource allowance. So they meet their assets are completely spoken for, and again, they're going to be considered otherwise eligible, and their income is going to be less than their cost of care. So what did we just do to their income? So let's first take a look at George's income. He had income from Social Security and pension of $2,400. We now have this Medicaid compliant annuity income of $6,465 for the next 10 months, which means George's new income is $8,865. Mary, she had income, Social Security and pension of $2,100. She has this new Medicaid compliant annuity income of $6,765. So her new income is now also $8,865. Now you may be saying to yourself, wait a second, Aaron, but their cost of care is $9,000. They're still short. And you are correct, and we do that on purpose. Again, we want to build in a small buffer zone to avoid being right on the edge of Medicaid eligibility, because if their total income is equal to or greater than their cost of care, they will not meet the income test. They will not be considered otherwise eligible. The penalty period will not start, and this plan just blew up, and you're going to have some very unhappy clients. So we want to make sure we build in a small buffer zone there to make sure that they are otherwise eligible and that penalty period does start. In this example, they have $135 shortfall each after the 10-month penalty period. That will total $2,700. So they could simply pay for that out of the $2,800 that we left them. Otherwise, typically, you'll have a conversation with the giftees and just make sure that they're aware that since you can only leave mom and dad with $2,800, if anything were to come up, ideally you'd use the gifted funds for that. Don't create a legal obligation, create a moral obligation, because they certainly don't have to do anything with their gifted money. It's their money. So you want to put this on a timeline if you're more one of the more graphical people. We're going to make the gift, purchase the annuity, and apply for Medicaid all in the same month. That's very important. We need to make sure we apply for Medicaid so they're considered otherwise eligible, because otherwise that penalty period will not start. So we apply for Medicaid. Medicaid comes back, says, great, we meet all the Medicaid criteria. However, since you gifted this $160,000, Each individual, George and Mary, will each have a 10-month penalty period we'll have to privately pay through. Then after the 10-month penalty period ends, the annuity stops making payments and the clients start receiving Medicaid benefits. So Medicaid will then pick up the difference. So what did we just do here? Well, after that 10-month penalty period ends, the annuity stops making payment, and George and Mary's monthly income reverts back to just their Social Security and pension. So for George, that was $2,400, and for Mary, that was $2,100. Now, each of them is allowed to keep a small amount, which is known as a personal needs allowance. This will be a state-specific figure. Most states, it's usually around $50. This is just a small amount that they can keep each month to spend on personal items. I like to refer to it as a haircuts and Snickers bars account, as that's pretty much all they can get for about $50 nowadays. But after they account for that, everything remaining, less if they have like insurance premiums, things like that, will go to the nursing home as their share of costs. To keep everything simple, we just left them at $50. So George's monthly Medicaid copay is $2,350, and Mary's copay will be $2,050. Again, this is their share of costs that will go to the nursing home each and every month, which means by qualifying them for Medicaid benefits, we are saving this couple $13,600 per month. All the while, they were able to make an immediate wealth transfer to their loved ones of $160,000. And this fact pattern that worked out to be just a little bit over half, it was around 55% of their total countable assets. So we went from just having them privately pay and being completely broke in 16 months to be able to saving to make an immediate wealth transfer of $160,000 to their loved ones. And then after getting them on Medicaid, they're saving $13,600 per month. What a result. If you do this plan for your clients, I assure you that their kids will be very happy with your services, and they'll be telling all their friends and family about the services you provided them and how you're able to not only make sure that they got the care that they needed, but able to protect money as well. So what are some additional considerations? Well, again, if one spouse were to predecease the plan, any remaining penalty would then be attributed to the surviving spouse. If both spouses predeceased the plan, since we're privately paying the entire time, there really is not an economic benefit to the plan as they were privately paying the entire time. However, this is where naming the state as a beneficiary, since they were privately paying, the state is likely not going to have a claim. Unless they're previously on Medicaid, so then any remaining benefit in that annuity would then go to their kids. As again, since they're privately paying the entire time, they likely will not have a claim if they predecease the annuities in the penalty period. And then again, if their cost of care were to increase or if they were to have some unexpected medical expenses that pop up, this is where having a conversation with the kids and letting them know, hey, your parents are only allowed to have $2,800, so if anything comes up, I'd recommend setting the gifted money aside in a separate account or, gifting it into an irrevocable trust. So there's constraints about how those funds can be used can really come into play. And again, creating a moral obligation to, hey, mom and dad only have $2,800. Something comes up, you have this gifted money. By no means are you legally obligated to do anything with it, but it sure would be nice if you could help your parents out if they have these unexpected expenses. So, setting kind of that type of consideration for things that may pop up that are unintended. And with that, so that brings us to the end. Does anyone have any questions, Amy?
All right. Thank you, Aaron. We do have quite a few questions here. Any questions that we don't get to today, we will certainly follow up with you. So no worries, your question will be answered. So let's get to a few here. First question for you, Aaron, are the annuity payments considered taxable income?
So for a non-qualified annuity, an annuity being purchased with post-tax dollars, only the small amounts of income or I'm sorry, only the small amount of interest that the annuity generates will be considered income to the client. If we use IRA dollars to purchase an annuity, since those are pre-tax dollars, when we purchase an IRA Medicaid annuity, then that monthly payment will be fully taxable, as that will be all pre-tax dollars. But for normal non-qualified post-tax dollars, just a small amount of interest the annuity pays will be taxable to the client.
All right, good lead up to the next question. Would this strategy stay the same if one or both spouses owned an IRA?
Yeah, great segue. So the planning strategy essentially remains the same. We'd still be looking at this gift and annuity strategy. Depending on the size of the IRAs and the size of the Medicaid-compliant annuities being purchased, again, we can purchase an IRA Medicaid-compliant annuity to spread that tax liability out. If the IRA is larger than the annuity for that individual being purchased, then we would just have to simply liquidate the remaining amount of that IRA, pay the taxes, and then either gift it or transfer it over to the other spouse to use to purchase their annuity. If it's a small IRA and the Medicaid annuity is larger than that IRA, then that individual would just purchase two Medicaid annuities, one with the IRA funds and then one with non-qualified dollars to make it so the total amount equals the amount of the Medicaid annuity, if that makes sense. I hope it does. So if that's $60,000 total annuity, that IRA of $30,000, they'd use the $30,000 IRA, and they purchase a second $30,000 annuity to equal $60,000 to generate the amount of income that they would need through the penalty period.
All right. We have time for one more question here. Let's see. Is there a planning strategy that involves gifting when only one spouse goes into the nursing home?
You can do that. It's going to be very case fact specific. We typically see that in a blended family situation where they might be on their second or third marriage and they want to ensure that the one spouse's kids get money. So yes, we can certainly do a gifting plan where they are married. Again, it's not going to be as advantageous as just giving all the money to the community spouse and having them purchase the annuity. But in a situation where there is a blended family and they want to ensure that the one spouse's kids get the money that they feel they want to give to it, yes, then we could do kind of a gift and annuity with that, yes.
Okay, great. That is all the time that we have for questions today. Again, if we did not get to your question, Aaron or another person on our team will be following up with you later this week. And a recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your attorney access account. If you haven't already created an account, you can head on over to krausfinancial.com/join to get started. Signing up is quick and easy and gives you access to all of our latest educational content. And speaking of educational content, I will let Aaron tell you about our Kraus Report.
Absolutely. If you have any, if you want to learn more, I encourage you all, regardless if you know everything or you don't, to request a copy of the Kraus Report. It is a fantastic pamphlet basically that talks all things Medicaid planning. It'll talk about Medicaid annuities, irrevocable funeral expense trust, long-term care planning, VA benefits. So it's a wonderful, wonderful resource. You can download a digital copy, and then also once you do that, you can request a physical copy if you want that as well. Again, regardless, I encourage you all to request a copy of the Kraus Report. It is a wonderful resource. You can get that at krausfinancial.com/Kraus Report. So thank you all for attending. Hope you enjoyed it and learned something of value. So thank you.
Thanks, everyone.